welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Courtney Raspin, a chartered counselling psychologist and clinical director of Oldham Health, a specialist eating disorders and mental health clinic in London. Courtney has over 25 years of clinical experience, including a decade in one of the NHS's largest eating disorder services. She's just co-authored a book called The Weight Loss Prescription with psychiatrist Dr. Max Pembleton, a book about the psychology of GLP-1 weight loss medications like Wegovy and Mounjaro. Given her background in eating disorders, I wanted to talk with her about what it's like to move into weight management work, what she's brought with her, and how she holds both perspectives. Before you listen to this episode, I just wanted to say that this has been a really difficult topic for me, and one that I have navigated a lot of different thought processes and conversations about with respect to my view of GLP-1 medications and the impact not only that they're having on people with eating disorders, but with the general population. I have been working with Courtney for over a year, and ever since these medications have become mainstream, we have had so many conversations. And this conversation, I guess, is kind of a summary of months and months of discussions. So I want you to know that it comes from a place of nuance, it comes from a place of curiosity, and it always comes from a place of compassion. I appreciate that this conversation may be difficult, but I do think that conversations like this are so important, and having these nuanced conversations and not seeing it as a black and white thing that we are often subject to within eating disorders, I think can be really powerful. So I ask you to open your mind, listen, and I would love to hear what your thoughts are about it. But also, if now doesn't feel like the right time, please, please do look after yourself. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Courtney. It's absolutely lovely to have you on the podcast. I wanted to start by talking about your career, I think. So you've worked in eating disorders for most of your career. What led you to start working in weight management?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't really choose to move into weight management. Weight management came to me. It was tier 3 and tier 4 NHS services that approached me because they needed eating disorders expertise. We're seeing patients coming through the bariatric pathway who are struggling with disordered eating, binge eating, other eating difficulties, and they needed help assessing psychological readiness for surgery. So it really wasn't kind of a, I'm seeking it out. It came to me and became very much an extension of the eating disorders work I do already.
And how did that transition feel like for you?
You know, it wasn't without its frictions, but I have to say it's really been a wonderful experience to expand my understanding of the universal ways that we use food, you know, of how we as human beings, how eating and moving through the world shapes our identities. And it's once I was able to kind of say, what is it that I'm doing and why? It's been wonderful. I feel like I'm a better eating disorders practitioner today because of the work that I've done with bariatric services.
I'd love to just ask you what that why is.
I think the why for me is that what I was seeing were people really struggling with obesity-related health conditions. Their quality of life was severely affected, their ability to move around in the world. And for me, helping people was really meeting their needs. And as a healthcare practitioner, my why is about improving quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's about helping. And I really feel like I have helped, not all the time, but enough of the time that it keeps me going. And yeah, that's my why.
And do you think that the work that you've done in eating disorders helps you to approach the weight management thing slightly differently? Or how do you think that's impacted your work?
Oh, 100%. Definitely. I think first, I see disordered eating where other people, even other healthcare practitioners, might just see overeating. You know, they always mark it as overeating. And that's such a general term. But when someone describes binging or restriction cycles or emotional eating or food preoccupation or any of those things, I can recognize that as a troubled relationship with food that needs psychological treatment, you know, not just like a meal plan, right? I think as well, I'm attuned to risk in a way that other people aren't because of my eating disorder's background. I know what a high drive for thinness looks like. I know what it feels like in the room, even when it's not packaged as anorexia, right? And that's so important when you're working in weight management. I know the warning signs that somebody might be pursuing weight loss for reasons that could harm them because of the eating disorder's background. I think the focus on body image. Certainly. The eating disorders field, we've been doing this forever. We know that forced body positivity, it just doesn't work. We know that weight loss doesn't automatically fix body image. And we know that people need practical tools for changing bodies and for living in changing bodies. And that's why the book that we've written focuses on body neutrality rather than body positivity. So I think I bring all of that into the weight management work.
What would you say is the distinction between body neutrality and body positivity?
I would say in general that, you know, body positivity is about telling yourself you love your body even when you don't. At its extreme, it's kind of a forced positivity. And we know that that doesn't work, versus body neutrality is very much about not necessarily just learning that you don't have to like your body in order to treat it with basic dignity and respect. Yeah. How to live peacefully in a changing body without tying your worth to how you look.
Yeah. And I think the aspect of body neutrality I find really interesting because it's something that was brought up quite a lot in my own recovery journey of like, you don't have to love your body every day. But when you're in a place of body hatred, I think, particularly in the eating disorder space, everything is very black and white. And so if I'm being completely honest with you, when people spoke about body neutrality, I'd be like, that sounds so boring. Or it's that shade of gray, isn't it? It's that shade of gray that we really hate. Like, I find any shade of gray really uncomfortable. Now that I'm recovered, I'm like, yeah, body neutrality. Sometimes I look in the mirror and I think, hot damn. And other times I'm like, okay, well, I guess this is us today.
Yeah. And that's what it's about. I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes you look in the mirror and you say, hot damn, because at least in the book, what we say is if appreciation arises naturally, great, welcome it. But don't force it, right? Mm-hmm. Don't force it.
Yeah. It's just, I guess what I was trying to say before is it's kind of hard to communicate to that to people, because when people are in a place where they don't like their body, to know that the outcome is going to be that they feel okay about their body rather than feeling super amazing and sexy and everything, it's not as glamorous.
It's not as easy a sell, is it? But at the end of the day, that's reality, isn't it? I mean, I think the idea that you're supposed to look in the mirror every day and think, you know, hot damn, every single day, that's not real life. It really isn't. Hopefully some of us have some hot damn moments. But some of the time you'll look, you'll notice negative thoughts. If you can step back and say, I'm having these negative thoughts about myself, I'm still going to, you know, brush my teeth. I'm still going to comb my hair. If it suits me, I'm going to put some makeup on and I am going to eat my healthy breakfast or my lunch or whatever is right for me.
Yeah, I think that's what's been a really key thing for me, is not letting the way I feel about my body dictate my worth, which is hard. But you mentioned your book and I'm really interested to hear from you. What led you to write the book?
So, you know, I co-wrote the book with Dr. Max Pemberton, and Max and I have known each other for a very long time. We actually met working in an NHS eating disorders service where he was a psychiatrist and I was a psychologist. And when these drugs came to market, they came to be available, he really saw early on the need to have ethical practitioners prescribing them in responsible ways. And he saw the risk to people with eating disorders. And so he started to do that. And he was starting to see what I was starting to see in my own practice, which is people getting prescriptions with no psychological support at all, losing the weight, stopping the meds, and then regaining everything. And really, we looked at each other and said, this is like a medically assisted crash diet. Right? People are using this. It's like bulimia, right? You know, it was mind-boggling. So we really said, we need to write this book and we need to write it quickly because we both believe that these medications can be genuinely helpful for the right people, but only if they use the window of opportunity that it provides to do the deeper psychological work. Because what the medication does is it quiets that food noise. You know, people talk about food noise all the time, but it doesn't change your underlying relationship with food. And that's what the program and the book is for.
And I do think that, you know, from my experience of being in this environment, it does feel like a dangerous space because, like you say, of the lack of regulation. But do you think that the drugs are inherently harmful?
No, I don't. I think all drugs need to be treated like drugs. No medication is right for everybody. And every medication has side effects. And I think one of my biggest concerns about these drugs is how easily people can access them. Right? They're serious drugs that require proper medical oversight. And people are getting them on the black market and they're buying them online without prescriptions and getting counterfeit meds. And people are dying. They are causing harm. It's not like buying a supplement. It's different. And they affect your gut and they affect your brain and they affect your reward pathways. So they need to be prescribed and monitored properly. And of course, for people with eating disorders, they're doing it by falsifying information. You and I know the lengths that somebody with a high drive for thinness will go, right? When being thin matters more than being healthy, any weight loss tool is going to feel justified. And these can literally become weapons. So in that way, they can cause harm. They can also be tremendously transformative and beneficial for people. For, you know, the first time in their lives, the noise is quiet and they can get a sense of success and control and space to think while they do the deeper psychological work. So I don't think they're inherently harmful. I think what we know is that short term, they are safe. We don't know long term, you know, the early data is encouraging, but we can't put the cart before the horse.
I think it's such an interesting one, and I appreciate it's probably something that you have to look at on an individual basis. I'm gonna share maybe from my lived experience, because I think I hear a lot of people say, obviously, these drugs can be truly transformative for people. They can help people lose weight and have access to life again and you know, be health promoting. When I was at the depth of my eating disorder, the scales did not say I was overweight. But if you asked me in a court of law, was I overweight and did I need to lose weight? My answer would have been yes. And then with the additional element of the food noise, there was not a moment that went by that I wasn't thinking about food. So I may have sat there and really argued the point of why can I not have access to these? I wonder what your perspective would be there.
I think it's a really interesting point. Anybody with an eating disorder is going to recognize that food noise phenomenon, right? what to eat next, when to eat, planning the next meal while you're eating the current meal. I mean, this is, it's just part and parcel of having an eating disorder. So, you know, I can understand you'd be sitting, well, why can't I use these drugs? I'll do anything to stop that noise. And the thing is, food noise isn't one thing with one cause. In binge eating or obesity, the noise is often driven by reward pathway dysregulation or emotional eating, years of weight cycling or diet cycling. And the GLP-1s can quiet that. I think in restrictive eating disorders, the food noise is caused by restriction itself, right? It's your body screaming for fuel. So if you give someone a drug that enables more restriction, that won't treat the noise. It makes the underlying problem worse while masking the signal. And the whole masking of the signal thing is important if you have an eating disorder and you're on these medications, maybe not anorexic, because the minute you come off the drugs, those hunger signals are going to come back anyway. And that's why we're saying we need to do the deeper psychological work. So that's kind of where I stand on that. Now, I do sometimes wonder, and I want to be really clear that this is pure speculation, Hannah, okay? This is just me wondering whether in a completely different context with very, very careful psychological support, these meds might theoretically help someone by reducing anxiety around food enough that they could actually eat more. But that's just me thinking out loud, right? Not a recommendation. They are completely contraindicated for anybody with an eating disorder, with anorexia, with bulimia, anybody with a high drive for thinness. There's no evidence for what I'm saying. And I have no idea how it would work in practice. But
I think you'd struggle with ethics for that study.
It's a wondering.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting, kind of tangentially, but I know that there's like ketamine assisted studies going on, and the reason behind that is to support the depression often associated with low weight and anorexia. And the theory is that if we support the depression, that will then help somebody engage in their treatment, and then they will, as a byproduct, eat rather than just giving them a meal plan and expecting them to eat. So
yep.
I can see where the logic is coming from. I think maybe it's one to be explored more.
Look, we know how dangerous these drugs can be for people who restrict. We see it clinically all of the time. They're absolutely contraindicated. It is a discussion that I've had and kind of just pondered over. We're still so early in the research.
But do you know what? I think that it's having these conversations is really important, having these nuanced conversations, because I personally don't believe that the treatment that we currently have is enough for everybody. And I think that if we can have these conversations and be open to exploring new ideas safely, then I think that's a really great step in the right direction. In terms of the psychological support or the psychological work within weight management, what does that look like?
I would say that psychological support in weight management is about understanding and changing your relationship with food, right? Not just what you eat, but why you eat the things you do, when you do. Really understanding that. And that includes understanding your eating patterns, right? Like, are you a feast or famine eater? Are you an emotional eater? Are you a grazer, for example? Because each pattern has different triggers and needs different approaches. And treatment is about slowing things down. And I like to say, from going kind of automatic into manual for a while, because we all go into automatic. And when we're trying to change a habit that maybe isn't serving us, we kind of have to just go into manual for a bit. I think one of the key things that pertains to GLP-1 use and coming off of them is learning to recognize hunger and fullness cues. Again, what is hunger to one person may be completely different to another person. And the cues somebody associates with hunger. We all assume, well, everybody gets a grumbling belly. Well, that's not always true. Some people will start to eat, you know, if we introduce the hunger and fullness scale in the book. When do you start eating? When do you stop? Some people don't stop till they're completely stuffed. And they're frightened to stop at like a 6 or 7. Well, why is that? Is it fear? What are you scared of? Where does that come from? Are there early childhood patterns that meant that food was scarce? So again, this is all tailored medicine for each person, looking at their individual patterns of eating. For many people for whom bariatric surgery and GLP-1s may be appropriate, you see a lot of emotional eating. And I like to say excessive emotional eating, because I think some emotional eating is completely normal and healthy, right? But there's a reliance on food as a way of coping with distress. So it's about developing alternative coping strategies. Or in the book, we call it the alternative cookie jar, kind of non-food ways of coping with difficult feelings. Because if food's been your main coping strategy and suddenly it's not appealing, you're going to need something else, right? Body image work. We've kind of touched on that a bit, but learning how to live peacefully in your body without tying your worth to your looks, that's part of the psychological work. And I'd say self-compassion. Anybody with an eating disorder, anybody that I've ever worked with, really bar none, has a pretty strong inner critic that's been telling them what to do, often for years. You know, you're weak, that you're lazy, that you're undisciplined, that you should try harder, that you're a failure. It's horrific. And that voice doesn't help anything or anyone. And I really credit compassion-focused therapists and researchers for really bringing that part of treatment to light, because I think it's so effective when it comes to the inner critic in a way that maybe traditional CBT is less so.
Yeah. I think the compassion piece is really interesting. And I definitely noticed shifting out of my eating disorder into a more recovered life, that critic shifting into everyday life. And so very important to work on that compassionate side. Something that you just mentioned, you said about when food is your only coping mechanism, and then that I can't remember the word that you said, but it was kind of like you're not really wanting to eat anymore. Is that the impact of the medication?
You know, for some people, it's an unexpected outcome. Because everything's, oh, I'm not going to have an appetite. It's going to be amazing. But if food has been your way of connecting with other people, if food has been the thing you turn to when you feel sad or anxious, and all of a sudden eating makes you feel sick, that can be very disorienting, incredibly disorienting. And that is part of the psychological work. It's also what doctors are not preparing patients for when they go on these drugs. They think, oh, they'll just lose weight and they'll be great. I think we're going to see a huge fallout. I really do. And that it's going to be the eating disorder specialists will be picking up the pieces from that fallout.
And I guess if you don't have an appetite, how do you relearn the hunger cues?
That's an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked. And it's one of the things that really gets that eating disorders practitioners and speaking with people who are starting to work with clients coming in on GLP-1s, because we're really struggling to know what to do, because all of the things that we're taught to help people with, well, like, let's keep track of your hunger cues and let's see, you know, where on the hunger fullness scale you are and what was your appetite like and was it a mouth hunger or was it an eye hunger? All of this stuff, I don't feel hungry anymore. So you can't do that traditional eating disorders-based work. So what we recommend in the book actually is a three-phase system. That you titrate up to a weight loss dose, you get within your goal weight, and then you titrate down to a maintenance dose for about a year, is what we say. Now, the purpose of that is so then you can do the psychological work. Because if you're titrating down, then those signals of hunger will start to return, that food noise may start to return. But you're in a better position then to start to respond to those in a way that feels controlled. You can always titrate up and titrate down a little bit. So it almost gives you this bit of control back. It also gives your body a chance to establish a new set point. Because if you've been at a very, very high weight for a long time, your body's going to fight to get back there. because that's what our bodies do. Say, oh, we're in famine. If you lose a lot of weight very quickly, your body's going to claw to get back there. So you can't just drop the medication. You really can't. So we say that in that year, and again, the order of when you do the psychological work is debatable, but we are saying in that year, the best time to do it when you're on this maintenance dose is do the psychological work. Mm-hmm. Really, really do it. And interestingly, it's a bit of an aside, but, and I just did a post on this actually, we're seeing so many people who are taking these meds, and then because they're not hungry, they're thinking, great, I'm just going to eat as little as possible. And they're passing out in parking lots. Mm-hmm. And they're, because they don't understand that you still have to nourish your body, that just because you have less of an appetite doesn't mean you don't need to eat well. This is an opportunity to learn how to eat well, how to nourish your body, not to treat it like a crash diet.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've known people in the past who have had bariatric surgery, and they've gone from eating 20 chicken nuggets to 2 chicken nuggets. And it just misses the point of kind of establishing that healthy lifestyle. But I think a question that's just like digging in my brain that I feel like people will be asking is, even, I guess it's like, where do we draw the line between this support being health optimizing and just also aligning with the thin ideal, or, you know, that everybody just needs to be smaller? Because I think, like, I can't position it, and I want to ask you what you think.
It is an incredibly difficult question, because I think people are using these drugs as enhancements, or what they're calling enhancements, and as aesthetic accessories rather than to improve health. These drugs are for obesity-related health conditions. That is how we improve health, right? Mm-hmm. They are not meant for somebody who feels they would like to lose 10 pounds. But unfortunately, given the society we live in, they are being abused in that way. And to me, I see that as an abuse. It's so difficult. I think it's the job of regulators and doctors to screen better, so that it's more difficult to access them. Mm-hmm. I think we have a responsibility, a social responsibility, in a way, to ensure that these drugs are being accessed by the people that can benefit from them. Now, you could argue, well, okay, body autonomy, great. You know, if that's what you want to do, fine. That doesn't quite sit with me. I believe in body autonomy, but I think when you live in a culture that values thinness, particularly in women, are you really making an autonomous choice? I think that's a whole other discussion. But as an eating disorders professional who's been in this world, in this field for a long time, I feel very strongly that we need to continue to see a wide range of bodies that are healthy out there being promoted, a wider range of beauty. Now, that said, I think at the very low weight ranges and the very, very high weight ranges, we see pathology. We see illness. And I don't think that's being anti-fat. I don't think that's endorsing diet culture. I think that's just biology.
Mm. Yeah. And I just think it's such a tricky one, because it's so ingrained in us that, you know, just as a random example, I remember when I was talking to my mum about her wedding day, and I asked her why she lost weight for her wedding day, and she said, because it was my wedding day. And it was just like, she literally, she didn't think anything badly of it, or she didn't think about like the consequences of it or anything. It was just, that's how it is. And so I think when it comes to these medications, I'm not mad at the people that are using them to lose weight, because it's the pressure. I think it's just, as you said, the role of regulators to really make sure that people are doing this safely, and, you know, the people that they are appropriate for can have access to them.
My position is that these medications are to treat obesity-related health conditions, not body dissatisfaction. Mm. Right. And that if somebody is actually struggling with how they feel in their body, or the relationship with food, or difficult emotions that they've been managing through eating, those need psychological treatment, not a weight loss drug.
Mm, absolutely. Have you received any negative or like questionable responses from colleagues?
Well, we are in the UK, so people are, I think the way that it's been responded to has been more of a not engaging rather than a direct.
Very British.
Yes, I've learned. There are people who, like me, believe that we as eating disorder practitioners need to be in this world, need to be in here, because if we're not, then it's really going to go downhill, right? And at the same time, there are a lot of people in the eating disorders world that believe if you're focusing on weight, you're not being weight inclusive. And I completely understand that. I really do appreciate that argument. And when I said it was not frictionless earlier, I think that's what I had to get over. Mm. I said, why am I doing this work? What am I saying by doing this work? And I had to really examine that belief to square it what I'm seeing clinically. And I've come to disagree with that statement. I think that being weight inclusive means treating people with dignity at any size. It doesn't mean dismissing their health concerns. And if somebody has obesity-related health conditions affecting their quality of life, that's not endorsing diet culture. I think once I was able to really challenge and examine that, and it was not easy, and I had a lot of discussions with supervisors and colleagues, I was able to lean into working with this population and what they could actually teach me about the way that we use food. And it's taught me a lot, Hannah.
Mm. What would you say is the biggest thing that you've learned?
The psychology of working in weight management is so similar to the psychology of working in eating disorders. And that has made me love food even more and lean into joyful movement even more. And that I think I have learned that people's relationship with food is far more complicated than most people outside of the eating disorders world even can begin to imagine. And if they could understand the suffering, they could understand the pain that people live with every single day, there'd be much more kindness.
Yeah. And I think from the conversation that we've had today, you know, I think the initial concern for me when the rise of GLP-1 medications came about was people with eating disorders. And I do still believe that they are a high-risk population. But I think without the education and the support, the general populace as well, you know, like you said, we've all got a relationship with food. Therefore, that can all be affected.
100%. And I share your concerns about people with eating disorders accessing these medications. I really do. But I don't think polarization helps anyone. Mm-hmm. I wish the weight management world understood that most of the people that are accessing these medications may have disordered eating. And I kind of wish the ED community could see that helping somebody with obesity-related health conditions isn't the same as endorsing diet culture. And if we can start there, then I think we can start have conversations, because this is new. A lot of this is debatable. It's important to debate. Because I don't have all the answers, but I want to be part of this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's like what I said to you before, having these nuanced conversations is difficult. You know, we've had multiple conversations and I've been brought to tears, not by you, by you,
to be fair.
by the things that are being brought up and the impact. And I know for me, you know, if I'm being completely honest, a massive emotion I felt towards them is jealousy and resentment of why can other people access that and I can't. But by having those conversations and putting it out there, that then allows for people to get the support because they don't think they're alone in it.
Absolutely. I think the education is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. So final question, if somebody in eating disorder recovery or you know, I would, let's say just anybody, because I don't think, as we've just said, it's not just people with an eating disorder that could potentially be a risky choice. What would you want them to know about starting GLP-1 medications?
If someone is in eating disorders recovery, the first thing I would say is that if you have anorexia or a history of significant restriction, these medications are dangerous for you. There's no evidence available today to suggest that it is helpful for you in any way, and I cannot say that strongly enough. So I just want to start there. They're absolutely contraindicated. They enable restriction. They mask your body's desperate nutritional needs, and they can't be lethal. We are seeing this in eating disorder services across the country. Do not access them by falsifying information, because your life is too valuable. That's the first thing that I would say. For bulimia, the picture is also concerning. Again, there's just no evidence at present to support taking these. If you have bulimia right now, appetite suppression can trigger severe restriction between binges, and that can make the cycle worse rather than better. So the evidence is incredibly limited. Just say no. For people who are further along in recovery or those with binge eating disorder, picture is a little bit more nuanced, little bit. The medications may help reduce the impulse to binge, but only as part of a comprehensive treatment with psychological support, not instead of that support, right? So that's what I would want to say. And I know how easy it is to only hear what you want to hear. If you're supporting someone, I'd encourage you to ask them, what's driving this? What's driving this desire? Is it genuine concern about health conditions, or is it an eating disorder trying to find a new tool? And it's important to be curious rather than judgmental, but be honest, be honest. So I think that's what I would say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you so much. And I think you put that incredibly. And I did especially like what you said about you can hear what you only want to hear, because I've definitely been known to do that in the past. Absolutely. Yeah. It's very difficult not to. So to finish us off, would you like to tell us about your book and when people can get it?
Sure. So it's called The Weight Loss Prescription. It is written by Dr. Max Pemberton, who is a consultant psychiatrist, and me, yours truly. And it is on the bookshelves the 26th of February. It's available for pre-order on Amazon. And I would recommend it to anybody who is considering going on GLP-1s, who is on them and is frightened to come off, or anybody who wants to develop a better relationship with food. I think it can be useful for healthcare practitioners who want to understand more about the space. The first half really is more about how to use them safely, who they're for and who they're not for. And the second half is a 12-session psychological program to help you really examine and change your relationship with food, so that if you do decide to go on these and then come off, those changes can last far beyond the medication.
Well, I think it is absolutely needed. So thank you so much for the work that you've done and for the conversation today, because I really appreciate that nuance. So it's been lovely to chat to you.
Always lovely chatting with you, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.